Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
Hi, I'm Frances Anderton. This is DNA. On today's show, Puss Puss makes cats into cover girls. Cat Fancy has been renamed Catster. What happened to the traditional warm and furry cat magazine?
We had a huge list of names. Cool for Cats, Pussy Galore. But as soon as I came up with Puss Puss, I just knew that's the one because it's got the right kind of level of cheekiness and naughtiness. And I think that's kind of what cats are about.
Hear from editor Maria Giardina on Gideon Brow's report coming up in a moment. Before we get to that, though, might you consider a solo bike ride across America? And if so, would you choose a sturdy, heavy New York City city bike with just three gears? Well, that was the ride of choice of 35-year-old New York commuter Jeffrey Tannenhouse. This past Saturday, he pedaled into a welcoming crowd at the Santa Monica Pier. He was looking very relaxed for someone who had just spent 5 months riding up to 40 to 60 miles a day. He'd covered 3,020 miles. He'd crossed 19 states, most of it on Route 66. And he was welcomed at a party hosted by riders on the city's Breeze Bikes.
Thank everybody for coming and this exciting event where we have East Coast meets West Coast bike share.
Cynthia Rose is director of Santa Monica Spoke. That's an advocacy group. And for bike share enthusiasts, Jeffrey's ride was a heroic validation of the system. For many, the trip also held a great mystique. Nick Richard is a middle school teacher and host of a podcast called Bike Talk.
Just the fact that anybody rides at all across the country is a big deal, but to take a city bike, of course, I mean, is heroic. It's slow is one thing, it's harder, but it's also like it's a fantasy, you know, to just take one of those city bikes and keep going and just keep going.
So how did Jeffrey just keep going? As he caught his breath and was plied with drinks and food at the happy hour on a terrace, glowing in the setting sun, he told us two-wheel version of On the Road.
I was very unhappy at work. I was a corporate event planner for an agency in a windowless office where the employees were encouraged not to take lunch or to eat lunch at their desks.
In Manhattan?
Yes, it was right near Times Square, but on a grungy side street. And the office was pretty grungy, and the best part of my day was bike commuting. That was when I felt free and empowered and happy.
And when we say bike commuting, what we mean is the New York Bike Share Program, also known as City Bike.
That's correct. I mean, I have my own road bike. It's nothing fancy. I bought it used, and I would commute on it sometimes, but locking it up was always a problem. I would be thinking about it during the day. Is it going to still be there at the end of the day, or is it going to rain later in the day? Then I wouldn't want to ride to work. But with the bike share and these one-way rentals and the very sturdy bikes, I instantly took to using those bikes to get to work and to get all around town. It was pretty much my exclusive form of transportation. There were months where I maybe took the subway twice under much duress because I felt cheated. Passive commuting was, it was terrible. And active commuting and being in charge of your own destiny was so gratifying compared to what I was doing sitting in a cubicle being told what to do and that I wasn't doing it well enough. That I just wanted to break free on one of those shared bikes, and I thought a lot about it. And eventually, when the job wasn't working out, and I left, and my apartment lease expired, I had nothing else keeping me in New York. I have some side businesses that I can run remotely, some side projects, and I said, all right, you know, let me give this a go, see how far I can get. And never in my imagination did I think it would take 5 months or that I would actually be on the Santa Monica Pier for sunset with a city bike.
And how was the bike to ride? Was it a bit of a clunker or an easy ride?
Well, it's certainly not your ideal touring rig. However, because I had been on it so much in New York, my body acclimated, so that when I was pedaling up the Manhattan Bridge, and there is quite an incline going over the bridge, I was able to pass people on their own bikes on a city bike while sitting down and just sort of fly uphill. And it is a heavy bike, but that heaviness also translates into a sturdiness. And these 2-inch tires came in handy on gravel roads, on rocky trails, where normal thinner tires would have certainly failed.
What was the feeling when you just went west, just headed west, and had this great expanse ahead of you?
I was extremely nervous because I was, you know, I am a rule follower, and I knew I wasn't supposed to be doing this, but I took a ferry from the east side of Manhattan to the top of the Jersey Shore because I wanted to get as far away from Manhattan as fast as possible. And going west from Manhattan, you have really no good options. The George Washington Bridge is about it. So my solution was to just zip over to the Jersey Shore on a ferry and get as far away from the city as possible. So the more mileage I put between myself and Manhattan, the less likely I was to turn back. So I got off the ferry, and immediately I heard people waiting to get on, like, oh, I don't think you're supposed to bring a city bike out of the city. And I felt shameful. I'm like, oh, I'm not supposed to be doing this, and what's going to happen? And I was extremely nervous. And by the time I got down the Jersey Shore, which took me about 4 days, it was the first time I kind of relaxed, and I was like, all right, you know, nobody's coming looking for this bike, and it's just up to me now to see how far I can get.
At this point, you might be wondering if Jeffrey Tannenhaus had to pay a fine for absconding with a city bike. Yes, he did. He was fined the maximum overtime charge of $1,200 plus tax for not returning the bike within 24 hours. And then he carried on pedaling. He stayed on couches and in guest rooms that he found through a cyclist hospitality network called Warm Showers. And he kept on going until he got to Joplin, Missouri, where he hit Route 66.
Actually, Route 66 was probably the most disappointing part of the road, because I didn't know much about Route 66. I knew that people were nostalgic for it and that there were quirky landmarks. But the condition of the roadway was so poor in so many places that I was battling some serious pavement neglect and desolate stretches of, you know, 40, 60 miles with nothing.
I think I read in The Guardian something about the South. Your parents were worried about you going to the South. Is that right?
Yeah, they were worried about a liberal New Yorker crossing the country on a bicycle. Could be a recipe for disaster. I've done a lot of international traveling, and, you know, they haven't been that concerned when I've gone to places like Myanmar, Colombia, the United Arab Emirates, or Oman, and right around at the you know, the wars in the Middle East, and I just went traveling there by myself. I mean, they were concerned, but not as concerned as they were when I told them I was going to bike across America. They were really upset.
What did they think was going to happen to you?
That I could get attacked or you know, run off the road, hit by a car, shot, like any number of unfortunate situations could arise, because there is, unfortunately, motorists who really hate bicycles. On my ride, I did the most I could to be accommodating to motorists, because I was a guest wherever I went. And for the most part, you know, I rarely got honked at, surprisingly. So it was a great experience. I don't think I'll do it again. I think it was a one-shot deal. And I'm happy that I was able to fulfill a dream, as well as to educate people about bike sharing and have productive conversations with bike advocates and bike sharing companies all across America, and bring awareness to the fact that I'm just a regular bicycle commuter. I don't have any fancy gear. Right now I'm wearing these running shoes with holes in them and ripped gym shorts. You know, I don't have any spandex suits. And I'm on a 45-pound bike with three gears, so...
Have City Bike called you and asked you to be their poster boy?
Absolutely not. They were in a tough position. They could not endorse me for what I was doing because it does not support their their mission of bike commuting within New York City for short trips only. And they also didn't want to condemn me, because then they look like the bad guy going after this guy who's giving them free publicity, basically. So their position was to take no comment, and I have not had any contact with them.
You haven't probably yet processed the fact that you're really finished, but what do you do now? Do you turn around, fly back to New York, and go back to work?
No. This was about my leaving the rat race. So the last thing I want to do is go back to New York and start applying for jobs, find another apartment, and enter the same cycle of misery that I tried to and successfully broke free from. So this was about discovering new places to be, new things that I can do, and I'm very much interested in starting my own business revolving around hospitality and creating travel experiences for other people to enjoy. And I think I might want to try that in Oklahoma, where I had the sort of the best chemistry with people in Tulsa. In Brooklyn, you know, they have enough, like, you know, trying to make it. But in Tulsa, they're very supportive. And I chatted a lot of different business owners and who heard about what I was doing, and they were very encouraging. And it was great to get to meet the people who are kind of running the city and meet other young, progressive people trying to make a difference and making the city more sustainable, more livable, and more exciting, and opening up new businesses. And it felt like a city that was on the rise, whereas cool places like Portland and Austin, Brooklyn, San Francisco, they've already come into their own.
Jeffrey Tannen has biked a total of 3,020 miles. Now he's figuring out how to ship the bike back and redock it in New York City.
In the spirit of bike sharing, I would like to return it to the ecosystem from where it came.
That's Jeffrey Tannenhaus. I'm Frances Anderton. For more on Santa Monica's bike share, go to DNA's website. You're listening to DNA. It's awards season, and not just for the movies. Coming up, architecture's biggest prize goes to someone very few people had heard of. And the shortlist of architects for President Obama's library makes one wonder, does diversity matter in the awarding of this very important commission?
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW radio.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. And in a moment, we're going to hear why cats are hot in today's lifestyle magazines. Before we get to that, though, architecture awards may not matter as much as the Oscars, except to architects, who watch with great interest the Pritzker Prize. The biggest prize in architecture is given annually to a designer who gets $100,000 and will be feted this year at a dinner at the UN headquarters in New York. LA's Frank Gehry and Tom Main are past recipients. So are Zaha Hadid and Rem Koolhaas. And the award has been criticised by some for promoting so-called starchitecture or showy buildings for deep-pocketed clients. Then in 2014, it was given to Japanese architect Shigeru Ban, who's known for refugee housing made of found materials, as well as institutional buildings and houses. Some critics then complained that his design abilities were not strong enough to have won the prize. Now it's come to 2016's choice, which was announced earlier this month. Cliff Pearson is an adjunct professor at USC School of Architecture.
The winner is Alejandro Aravena, and he is a 48-year-old architect from Chile. He has really developed an unusual practice. He has done some very striking, iconic buildings, but he also spends a significant amount of his time with his practice doing low-income housing and doing housing for workers. And it's an interesting combination of both high architecture and also socially engaged architecture. And a lot of the debate in the architecture world is, oh, do you have to do socially engaged architecture or do you do the Zaha stuff? And I think what he's shown is you don't have to make a choice between one or the other. That actually good architecture is good architecture.
So in terms of the good architecture piece, what is good about his architecture?
It's very muscular, often in concrete, with poured concrete, with very assertive presences. He has a great sense of composition, but he also has this amazing feel for rugged materials that actually engage people. So they're tough materials, but he's able to use them in a way that makes you feel welcome. And I think he's done a similar thing with his worker housing, where he's used very inexpensive materials, but he's put them together in a way that make them feel at home. He also is really shrewd working with budgets. The first set of worker housing he did, he got some money from the government. It was a very small amount of money. And they realized they couldn't do very much with it. So they understood the people who would be living in these houses. And most of them are workers, and they know how to build things. So what they did is they provided the bare minimum. They provided a platform, a foundation. They provided plumbing. They provided the basic infrastructure of the house and a simple shell. And then they realized that the people who would be living there would be adding on to them. And they used that. And, some architects don't like it when somebody else comes and alters their buildings afterwards. But this architecture was actually designed with that in mind.
Do you know how he comes to get these projects, such as this workers' housing project you've described?
Well, a lot of them, especially the worker housing, they were self-initiated. He had set up a nonprofit portion of his practice. And I think the first project he did, he raised a lot of the money himself. So he didn't wait for someone to come to him. He saw that there was a need for this type of work, and he said, I'm just going to go out and do it.
There's a little bit of puzzlement surrounding the selection, in as much as Aravena was on the jury himself of the Pritzker up until very recently. Talk about that.
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised by that. Certainly, you don't want to preclude people from getting the prize just because they served on the jury, because you want to have people on the jury who are talented people in their own right. Having it so soon after he stepped down from being a juror,
which was last year, is that right?
So maybe that was a little bit too close. But he's a very talented architect. He represents, I think the best of a certain generation. I think it also opens the eyes of a lot of people, especially in America, to the really great architecture that's happening in South America. In Chile, there's a whole bunch of really talented architects. In Chile, in Argentina, in Brazil, and a lot of people in the U.S., even people in the architectural world, aren't as familiar with what's happening down there as maybe they should be. And I think maybe this is a little bit of a wake-up call saying, you know what, pay attention to South America.
Cliff Pearson is adjunct professor at USC School of Architecture, and he directs the school's American Academy in China. I'm Frances Anderton, and we've been talking about this year's Pritzker Prize. Now on to another big story in architecture, and that's President Obama's library that will be built on the south side of Chicago. A shortlist of architects has just been announced. First, though, a word on why this commission matters. Eric Lasher is an architect in Chicago, and he's co-author of the book Plans of Chicago.
I think presidential libraries are, there's a range from the conservative to the unremarkable, I think. The Gerald Ford Library was probably architecturally maybe the least distinguished of recent presidential libraries, but there have been some good ones. But I think this one has tremendous potential. I think it has a lot of meaning for the Hyde Park neighborhood in the city of Chicago. And I think that Barack Obama's really his transformative presidency, his role as the first African-American president of the United States is an extraordinary historic occurrence. And I think the building hopefully will have an impact that is commensurate with the Obama presidency.
There was a lot of, I guess, chatter about how the Obamas being so progressive, would would probably choose an African-American architect or a woman architect.
Yes.
And they do have a very prominent African architect, yes, on the list, yes, David Adjaye. They didn't pick the Chicago woman architect that was expected, Jeannie Gang.
Right.
Is the money in Chicago on an African or African-American architect?
You know, sometimes you can be very cynical about thinking that the narrative is an overwhelming component of the project and the choice of architect and their backstory. Playing a role in their selection, it's not always the best criterion for a selection, but in this case, I think the narrative could be very compelling. I think where the library is being built, and I think the personal story of Barack Obama could make a very compelling argument for an African or an African-American architect.
So who's going to design this significant building? Well, a shortlist of 7 architecture firms was announced at the end of last year, and a winner is going to be decided in the coming months. The list includes the Italian architect Renzo Piano, Norwegian Snøhetter, Chicago's John Ronan, and London-based Ghanaian-born David Adjaye. Back to Cliff Pearson.
The shortlist that has been put together is sort of an interesting list. It runs a real gamut. Everyone from Renzo Piano, who's, you know, a grand master, but, you know, is now, you know, I think close to 80 years old, or maybe at least 80, all the way to younger architects like David Adjaye and John Ronan.
Adjaye being African from Ghana, son of an ambassador, very well-regarded architect, John Ronan being Chicago-based.
Right. David Adjaye does have an office now in New York City. He has at least 1 foot here in the U.S. already. He's a very interesting choice. He's done some really beautiful small studios for artists. He's done a few very beautiful small museums. He did a museum in Denver that's quite lovely. His biggest project, at least in the United States right now, is the National African American Museum that he is designing with Phil Freelon and Davis Brody Bond. And that, I think, will be opening later this year. And that's right on the National Mall. So that's obviously given him a national profile in the U.S. that he didn't have before. His work tends to be quite rugged. A lot of his early work was actually painted black, which some people found off-putting. They're not normally warm and fuzzy buildings, so it could be an interesting choice. I think other interesting choices, I think Todd Williams and Billy Chin, I think they're two of the best architects in the United States and have been practicing for many years, but have not been given that great commission that I think they probably deserve. And I think they would do a really interesting job with this. Diller Scofidio Renfro, also a very talented New York-based firm. They just designed the Broad here in Los Angeles, so people in L.A. are familiar with their work.
But so far, his shortlist is all architects who are working in, one could call it, the sort of the modernist tradition. There's no neoclassicists in the group.
Right. There's no Robert Stern, who designed the George W. Bush Library. And I think that's great. I mean, I think Obama's presidency, his attitude has always been looking forward. And, you know, I think it makes sense to select an architect who's vocabulary is one that's forward-looking. And I think forward-looking architecture deals with latest technologies, new materials, an openness. I mean, modernism has often been defined by materials like glass, which allow light and views inside. And I think those are interesting values to incorporate in a presidential library.
Cliff Pearson is adjunct professor at USC's School of Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. And we're going to conclude with a pet story, because it turns out that cats are in the vanguard of lifestyle publishing. Gideon Brow reports.
Face.
It's late on a Wednesday night, but this party on the roof of the Ace Hotel downtown is still going strong. Photo spreads from a British fashion and lifestyle magazine are projected on a white wall overhead as about 200 people drink, dance, and hobnob. What makes this scene just a little unusual is that some of the glamour shots projected overhead are of kittens. The magazine hosting this party is called Puss Puss, and it's as likely to be shelved under Pets as under fashion or design. The recent Ginger issue, for example, has a photo shoot of some pouty redheads holding a big ginger cat. Other layouts have featured leopard print, kitten-heeled shoes, and a Russian model who has the word meow tattooed inside her lower lip. Puss Puss printed an interview with Chinese artist Ai Weiwei, who puts photos of his cats on Instagram, and a history of the Black Panther Party. Bottom line, if you're hip and happening and have some remote connection with cats, you're fair game.
The way we described it to people from the beginning, that it was a magazine for people who love fashion, art, culture, music, all those sorts of things, but they also happen to be big cat lovers.
Maria Giudina founded the magazine last year in London. She's visiting L.A. for the Ace Hotel Party along with her husband Matt Robinson, who's an editor-at-large for Puss Puss, and associate editor Gemma Lacey. Lacey says it was clear from the start that theirs would not be one of those cat magazines focused on breeding or health. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
They're the kind of forefathers of cat editorial culture, and we're taking the torch on to the next level.
Maybe 20 years ago, if you had a question about grooming your cat or cat breeding, people actually had to turn to cat magazines for that kind of information.
Emma Bazilian is the senior style and culture editor at Adweek. She says that the ease with which people can get basic information online has forced the pet publishing industry to make some big changes. Is she surprised to see a magazine blending cats and couture? Not really.
Karl Lagerfeld's Cat Shoe Pet has become this like fashion megastar, and Taylor Swift is carrying her cats around everywhere, and Grace Coddington's whole Instagram feed is filled with cat sketches. You know, I think it makes sense that someone would say, let's do a magazine about cats and fashion.
The traditional cat magazine took a big hit last year when Cat Fancy, America's best-known feline periodical, experienced a kind of identity crisis. When it launched in 1965, Cat Fancy described itself as a voice devoted to the care, welfare, and adoration of all cats, meaning all pedigreed cats. But now it runs listicles, like The Five Stages of Bargaining with My Cat, and it's changed its name to Catster. As for the name Puss Puss,
we had a huge list of names. Cool for Cats, Pussy Galore. But as soon as I came up with Puss Puss, I just knew that's the one because it's got the right kind of level of cheekiness and naughtiness. And I think that's kind of what cats are about. When we were delivering the first shipment of magazines, we got directed to the, you know, to the adult section because they didn't know what kind of magazine it was.
Adweek's Emma Bazilian points out that Puss Puss reflects another trend. As the internet takes over the space that magazines once occupied, print publications have gone upscale, turning themselves into art objects or collector's items. That's certainly true of Puss Puss.
We print it in the UK, which is very expensive, but it's very important that people have a beautiful product that they want to keep and collect.
What about a magazine about art, fashion, design, and dogs? Would the staff of Puss Puss consider branching out?
Yeah, why not? We could do woof woof.
Matt Robinson says Maria Giudina might actually find that easier for one surprising reason.
She is allergic to cats.
Only a little bit.
And we have one.
We've got the Russian blue called Sputnik. So sometimes I have like some sneezing going on.
For DNA, I'm Gideon Brown.
I'm Frances Anderton. You've been listening to DNA. The show was mixed by JC Swatek. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Find more DNA on our blog at kcrw.com/DNAblog and follow us on our Facebook page at KCRWDNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Thank you very much for listening. Stay tuned for The World, coming up next.